Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back for the second hour of Catholic Answers Live Open Forum today. Jimmy Akin, our guest. All is right with the world. Maybe that last part might be an exaggeration, but not much of one on Open Forum Day. If you have a question about the Catholic faith, we would love to discuss it with you. 888-318-7884. Whether you're Catholic or not, please give a call. Maybe you have a question about the Bible and what Catholics believe about the Bible. Maybe something about various Catholic doctrines or teachings, maybe the moral teachings of the Church. Maybe a more general or question about religion or philosophy. All of that is welcome when Jimmy is here. 888-318-7884. A whole bunch of folks on the line, but lines do open up during the show. But if you want to get in before the top of the hour, start dialing pretty soon. Let's go to, first of all, hello again, Jimmy. I didn't say hello to you.
Hey there.
Start our second hour. All's well.
Oh, yeah.
Your status hasn't changed.
Not since the first hour. Not very much.
Good.
About 6 minutes later, further along in history.
Yes, right. Six minutes farther from your birth and closer to the
next gates. 6 minutes of my life.
Oh, okay. All right. Joe in Raleigh, North Carolina, watching on YouTube. Thanks for watching on YouTube, Joe. Your question for Jimmy.
Hi there.
Howdy.
Hi.
Has God given Mary power beyond intercession? Like, is it appropriate for us to ask Mary to do things for us directly rather than just praying for us?
Okay. By the way, Joe, I really want to compliment you for asking your question directly and not ladling it up with a bunch of unnecessary background about how the question arose. Aces to you. The answer is that we don't know. What the Church does know is that Mary prays for us like the other saints, and that God responds to her intercession when it's His will and does things. Grants requests and favors and blessings and things like that. It's possible that He has also given her some more direct way to influence the world, but if so, we don't know about it. And so sometimes people will say things like, you know, Mary, please do this or whatever. But the proper way to understand those would be in terms of Mary's intercession. At least that's the understanding that would be recommended by church doctrine. So if you say, you know, Mary, please grant this favor, that means please intercede with God so that He may grant this favor if He chooses, if it's His will. Now, you can obviously leave open the possibility if God's given Mary the discretion to intervene in a direct way herself, well, then that would be fine too. But we need to acknowledge that all the Church knows for sure is that God does respond to the intercession of Mary and the saints. Whether He's given them a more direct ability to intervene is something that we can wonder about, but we don't really know the answer in this life.
Okay, Joe?
Yep, that's good. Thanks very much.
All awesome. Right. Appreciate that call, Joe. That was well done. Done, Joe. Applause for you. Jay in Oregon, you are up next with Jimmy Akin. Jay, your question, please.
Thank you. My question comes from the New American Catholic Bible, Luke verse 26. Jesus says, if even the smallest things are beyond your control, why are you anxious about the rest? Mm-hmm. And my question is there a divinity that you think shapes our end so that, as Jesus says there, we really do have very little control over our lives, and what you think about that and how you interpret what Jesus is meaning there?
Well, Jesus is fundamentally reassuring people. There's a parallel passage in Matthew's gospel. If you look there as well, he has a similar discussion of this in the Sermon on the Mount, which is Matthew 5 to 7. And he is pointing out that there are things in life that we can control, like how we respond to situations. For example, he says, don't worry about what you're going to wear, or don't worry about what you're going to eat, or things like that. And so obviously, that presupposes, if he's telling us not to do those things, that presupposes we could do those things. We could worry excessively about what we're going to eat and what we're going to wear and things like that. So we can control those things in our lives. But there are other things he points out we can't control, like our height. You know, he cites, you can't make yourself a cubit taller. He similarly says you can't turn one hair on your head black or white. Certainly not without using dye or bleach. So
the day is coming, Jimmy.
Well, there are also things that we can't control. And his point is, don't worry about things that you can't control, and don't worry, like, because fundamentally you're in God's providential care. God loves you, and if you put God first, then he'll help you out, and he'll help you navigate the various challenges we face in life. And so don't have an exaggerated sense of control over things to where you worry about every little thing. Realize that you're in God's hands and he loves you and he will take care of you. And your task is to be close to God and discern his will and grow closer to him.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate that. And it just kind of got me thinking. And I was also reading this book on Abraham Lincoln, who said that motive was born before the man. And he believed that in something called the doctrine of necessity, and that there's just even the decisions that we make that we think we're making based entirely on our free will are influenced by the experiences we've been given in our life that we had no control over.
Well, certainly we are conditioned by things in our lives that we have no control over. There's a famous example from the 19th century of there was this guy who was a railroad worker who was in an accident and a railroad spike went through his head. And he survived, but his personality changed. And he started to develop antisocial tendencies because the part of the brain that regulates certain impulses was damaged in his case. And so, you know, that was something he obviously had no control over, that injury. So our attitudes and behaviors and the way in which we exercise free will can be shaped by things that happen to us that are beyond our control. But we nevertheless do retain free will, even if it's exercised within certain constraints. We do retain free will, and we're ultimately in God's hands. So even if something bad happens, even if we get a train spike through the head and we develop some antisocial tendencies, God knows that. He still loves us, and he'll take that into account in dealing with us.
Jay, thanks so much for that question. It strikes me as interesting, Jimmy, that the very fact of giving us commands, do this and don't do that,
it presupposes we have free will.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, we'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
We're waiting for your call. Grab that line and get on board.
Are the biblical miracles too far-fetched to believe? Dead people rising, blind people seeing? How can a rational person believe such things? Well, it might seem irrational to believe relative to our general background knowledge, but relative to specific evidence, the obstacle of improbability can be overcome. For example, it's improbable for someone to rise from the dead. But if there were credible eyewitness testimonies, as in the case with Jesus, then belief would be rationally justified. Second, many skeptics often don't consider the improbability of the reported miracle being false. With regard to Jesus' resurrection, it's unreasonable to believe the apostles died for what they knew to be a lie, or that many different people had the same hallucination at the same time on different occasions. So miracles are not too far-fetched to believe if there is sufficient evidence to justify belief. I'm Carlo Broussard with a Ready Reason for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Pope Francis said, "The key that opens the door to the faith is prayer." Join St. Paul Street Evangelization by running a prayer station in the public square. You don't need to be a professional apologist or theologian. Just listen to the needs of the people you encounter. Offer encouragement, take prayer requests, and pray with people. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Divine Intimacy Radio.
When you engage with the wisdom of saints this way, it stokes the fires of God in our hearts, encourages us, strengthens us, and gives us wisdom to deal with the difficulties of life. It also gives us wisdom that allows us to rise above all of the junk, to live with joy and peace in the midst of even the most difficult circumstances.
Divine Intimacy Radio, Sunday, 6:30 a.m., 1:30 p.m., and 11 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Open forum, Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. Now more than 20 years as an apologist here at Catholic Answers.
25.
More than 25 years, yes. Yeah. I guess I was thinking, I got confused with the show. The show this year became more than 20 years old, and you passed your 25-year mark as an apologist here at Catholic Answers. Jimmy's also the author of, a whole bunch of stuff, including The Drama of Salvation, and most recently, his most recent big tome was
A Daily Defense,
365 days plus one to becoming a better apologist. And you don't have a title for the as yet unpublished manuscript you're working on.
Yeah, I do.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, the working title has been Teaching with Authority, but I may suggest to Todd Aglioloro that we consider going instead with Doctrine, Dogma, and Theology, which I think may actually be a bit more of a grabber and more clearly convey the contents of the book.
Yeah, yeah. Do the marketing people get any say in the?
Oh, yes, they do. Oh.
Yeah. Don't be a fool, Cyril. Of course they do. Our first call, since we came back from the break, is Craig in Savannah, Georgia. I have to tell you, Craig, Savannah is one of my favorite places in the world. Used to work there in the summers. Craig is listening on the Catholic Answers app. Thanks for downloading the app. Craig, your question for Jimmy.
Hey, Jimmy. Sorry, good to talk to you guys. In Acts chapter 9, we read about a story about Peter raising a young woman named Tabitha, I believe, from the dead. Now, Tabitha, as you know, died after Jesus died and was risen from the dead. Mm-hmm. So when she died and before Peter rose her from the dead, where did her soul go?
The short answer is we don't know. One of the things that is unclear is the exact time that the soul disassociates from the body or goes into a dramatically different environment. According to some early Jewish belief, the soul actually hung around for a while, maybe as much as 3 days. And that's why it's significant that Lazarus was raised a number of days after he had actually died, that this was a significant – this couldn't be understood just as – you know, the soul was hanging around and got reattached to the body. It had like already departed on this view and had to be retrieved from the next world. So it's not entirely clear exactly what happens. We know the soul becomes ceases to serve as the life principle of the body at physical death. But exactly what happens thereafter and what the chronology of that is, we don't know. Presumably, Tabitha, being a Christian, was in a state of grace when she died and would have, if she did depart for the next world, go to heaven. But it's also possible other things could have happened. They could have said, actually, hang on, you know, kind of just hover around in this area because guess what? You're going back. And so we don't know for sure.
Would that be a possibility of purgatory? an example of, instead of being heaven or hell,
if she had a need for purification following death, then yeah, she could have experienced purification or purgatory after death. Yeah, that's it. That's possible. I wouldn't view it, though, as something I would use it in an argument of an apologetic nature, because it's not a slam dunk. She could have gone straight to heaven too. We don't know that that didn't happen. We really don't know what did. We can speculate about these things, and there aren't firm answers. Hypothetically, it's possible she didn't die in a state of grace and got lucky from being retrieved from the bad place. So, you know, Acts doesn't give us any reason to suppose that, but it also doesn't rule it out.
Craig, thanks so much for that call. Hope that's helpful to you. I like your use of the bad place, Jimmy.
Yeah, personally, I'm hoping to go to the good place.
Me too. But let me just ask you this. 25 years you've been doing this. Mm-hmm. Did you just recently start using the good place and the bad place related to a television program, or have you always done it?
I think people have used the good place and the bad place as euphemisms or indirect and circumlocutions for some time. I think that's a broad part of our culture.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay. I didn't know. Bob's visiting. He's in the studio here. Bob is from Columbus, Ohio. Mm-hmm. And he said his daughter, Sarah, married a fine young man, Hassan, from Morocco, who's a Muslim. Mm-hmm. And he says his grandchildren speak English and Aramaic, which actually surprised me. I would have thought Arabic. But starting at nine months, what's that?
Because Arabic is a major language in Morocco, whereas Aramaic isn't.
So starting at 9 months, they called Hassan, their father, Baba.
Mm-hmm.
And in English, they say Dada.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think this is related to the Aramaic word Abba?
It's certainly possible. Arabic is a cognate language to Aramaic. They're both languages in what's called the Northwest Semitic family. This is kind of like the Romance languages in Europe. Latin, as it changed over the course of time, eventually developed into several different related languages like French and Spanish and Romanian and Italian and so forth. And so those are all called Romance languages because they're descended from the one they spoke in Rome. Mm-hmm. And similarly, the Semitic languages all share common roots. So Hebrew and Aramaic and Arabic are all related. There are some others too. Egyptian is a West Semitic or Hamitic language, but it shares some common roots with those. And so Baba is a normal childhood term for father, just like daddy or dada is in English. And it's quite possible it's related in a direct way to Abba. The Hebrew word for father is Ab. It gets pronounced different ways, but it's Ab. And in Aramaic, because you put an extra ah on the end of a word to make it definite, it becomes Abba, and that same root with the A and the B
sounds
could easily lead to Baba in Arabic. I'd have to check just to verify that's what happened, but it's certainly related to a phenomenon that is known the world over. Children, as they grow in their ability to speak, initially are only able to make a certain number of sounds. And ah is one of the sounds that's very easy because it's basically blowing air out your throat and vibrating your vocal cords. But then the consonants that we make are where we restrict that airflow in one way or another. And one of the simplest ways to do that is by closing your lips entirely. And that gives us sounds like p and b. And once you learn to use your tongue, duh. And so those are early childhood sounds that get put together in words. Also, ma is another one where you close your lips.
Right.
And so those are all sounds that get used in early childhood words. And so you get dada, papa, mama, baba,
abba,
all over the world. Now, there's actually a very interesting book called The Origin of Language by a guy named Merritt Rulin. And he's got a fascinating thesis. See, linguists don't know. We can trace the history of languages back to a certain degree and figure out what even dead languages sounded like ancient Sanskrit and stuff, which English is actually kind of sort of descended from.
Yeah.
But there's a limit of how far back you can go. Linguists think originally there must have been some first language in the world, and it's called Proto-World.
Oh.
And Merritt Rulin has a thesis that if you look at widely separated language families, that you can identify some potential candidates for words that would have been part of Proto-World.
Oh, because they're so widely separated.
In very different language families in,
right. That would have to
in the Americas and Africa and everything. And interestingly, some of those words are aqua for water.
Mm-hmm.
And tick for finger or one, and mama, papa, and papa for mother and father, and kaka for brother. And
that didn't work out in English, that one.
It didn't. It doesn't in Greek either. But it's a fascinating, even though most scholars are dismissive of this claim that we could identify any words from Proto-World, it's still a very interesting read.
You know, we have so many words, and we live in a place where people speak English and Spanish all the time, and there are very many words like say, revolucion in Spanish is revolution in English.
Yeah.
But
Those are called cognate words.
I like false cognates. Like when English speakers tell Spanish-speaking people that they're embarazada.
Uh-huh.
Because that sounds like embarrassed, but
right.
It actually means pregnant.
Uh-huh.
And so it's a great false cognate.
There's another one that I heard Ricardo Montalban talking us. You know, he was actually a fan of Catholic Answers.
Oh, he was.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I once saw an interview with him where he was talking about this problem because he grew up speaking Spanish, and he was once at. Like a bus stop waiting for a school bus as a young man. And there was a girl there who was an English speaker, and he actually had a cold that day. And she asked him, she could tell he wasn't feeling well. And she asked him what was the matter. And he thought in Spanish, cold is a constipation of the nose. So he said constipation. Not realizing what that would mean in English.
Yeah, right. That happens all the time around here in Southern
California. I was once at a drive-up window in a taco stand, and I was ordering a Diet Coke with no ice.
Yeah.
But the speaker was so fuzzy, I was having trouble making myself understood in English. So I switched into Spanish.
Yeah.
And I said that I wanted un Diet Coke sin cielo.
Oh.
And I realized after I drove off, I'd ordered a Diet Coke with no heaven in it.
Yeah, with no heaven or sky.
Instead of no hielo, no ice.
Yeah. Yep. And that's down in Texas. You have that too, right? You have Tex-Mex down there with a funny mix of language. All right.
Another time, I was at World Youth Day in 1994 at Denver. I'm handing out Pillar of Fire, Pillar of Truth for the first time. There are these waves of Latin Americans going by me. I wanted them to know I'm not one of the anti-Catholics who was there handing out tracts.
Oh, yeah.
So I started saying, Viva el Papa, Viva el Papa, you know, long live the Pope.
Oh, long live the potato is what you're saying.
Well, no, and yeah, and I switched. I thought, well, okay, wait, Papa should be feminine. So Viva la Papa, Viva la... El gringo es loco. You know, he's saying long live the potato.
Well, if you look up long live the potato, or no, welcome potato on the internet, you will find a funny thing about when Pope Francis came to Washington, D.C. But I think it's not an urban legend. I think it's real.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever eaten an abogado?
I'm pretty sure I have.
You have not. That's a lawyer in Spanish.
Not what I was thinking of.
No, I know. Let's go to Francis in Quincy, Massachusetts. I know Quincy, Massachusetts. You used to live right by there over in Dorchester, listening on 1060 AM. Francie, your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'll try to make this quick. I'm a new convert. I just became Catholic, and my husband now has return to his faith as being Catholic.
Awesome.
One thing that we're encountering now is whether or not practicing Tai Chi or any form of martial arts is something that is against God. Are we causing any problems? He did it as a form of, you know, just exercising, feeling good, and now we're just starting to question whether or not that is actually okay for us.
Various forms of physical discipline are just fine. So if you're doing martial arts just as a way of exercising and disciplining your body and learning self-control and things like that, it's totally fine. So are the studying martial arts for purposes of self-defense or defending others. That's perfectly fine too. Those are legitimate goals. Where a problem can come in is when religious ideas start to get mixed with the physical discipline. Like Tai Chi, if I'm – and I may be mistaken here, but my understanding based on the name would indicate that some practitioners of Tai Chi could tell you that in the practice of the discipline, you have this energy called qi in your body that you're manipulating. Now, Iron Fist in the comic books really has that, but here in the real world, we don't. And so we shouldn't be mixing ideas about this esoteric energy in our bodies and we're manipulating it. But if you're treating a martial art purely as a physical discipline and a means of exercise or self-defense, that's fine.
Thank you, Francie from Quincy. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Jimmy Akin Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
Every question is important. Ask yours today on Catholic Answers Live.
It might be said that anti-Catholic notions of the Church's history are the original fake news. With all the misinformation being spread, where does one look for the truth? In The Real Story of Catholic History, Professor Steve Weidenkopf gives you the facts on over 50 of the most common misconceptions about Catholic history and shows how to answer them simply and powerfully. Whether it's to answer claims about Catholicism's supposedly pagan origins, old myths about the Inquisition that never seem to go away, or more modern errors that anti-Catholics put forth, The Real Story of Catholic History is an essential resource for every Catholic's bookshelf. Order your copy of The Real Story of Catholic History today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
As the legend goes, the Protestant Reformation began when Martin Luther nailed the list of his grievances with the Catholic Church to the door of All Saints Church in Wittenberg, Germany. But do you know the whole story? In Catholic Answers' brand new documentary, The Protestant Revolution, you will hear from top apologists Tim Staples, Jimmy Akin, Carla Broussard, Trent Horn, and Steve Weidenkopf as they expose the errors of Martin Luther and of the other so-called reformers. This DVD will give you a clearer understanding of our Protestant brothers and sisters, and you will be better equipped to engage them about what separates us and about what unites us. Order your copy of The Protestant Revolution today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting shop.catholic.com, or by asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Love that crazy drumming. Yeah, that's our own Nick Chamberlain with his rockin' band Nick Check and the Dead Century. And that means that's groovy music. Thanks for playing the whole thing, Nick. I love Groovy Music Thursday. It also very often means Jimmy Akin is here with us, and that's two bonuses for a Thursday afternoon. And it's open forum, which means anybody can call with any question at all about the Catholic faith, the Catholic Church, Catholic people, Catholic stuff. You're welcome to call with it. We go now to Tyler in San Bernardino, California, watching on YouTube. Tyler, we need a Catholic radio station in San Bernardino. We don't have one out there, but glad you watch on YouTube. Your question for Jimmy.
Hey, I'm new to Catholicism in general, but keep hearing a lot of disagreements with Vatican II. Hmm. So I was just hoping you could kind of give me some differences between Vatican I and Vatican II.
Okay, well, Vatican I was an ecumenical council. There have been 21 ecumenical councils so far, and Vatican I was held at the Vatican in Rome in the year 1870. And it released two documents. The first document is called De Filius, and it deals with the Catholic faith in general terms. And among other things, it infallibly defined the fact that it's possible to prove the existence of God. And it also had certain other teachings about faith in general, and it's a very interesting read. Then it also was able to do a document called Pastor Eternus, which deals with the role of the Pope in the church, and it's famous for, among other things, having infallibly defined the fact that the Pope is capable of teaching infallibly in some circumstances. Doesn't happen that often, but it does. It is something that's possible. Vatican II, Vatican I wanted to publish more documents than that, but there was a little thing called the Italian Revolution and another little thing called the Franco-Prussian War that interfered with the council's ability to meet, and so it had to be suspended because of the conflict that was going on, and so it didn't get to publish any more documents. And then 90 years later, Pope John the 23rd decided it was time for another council, and so he called the Second Vatican Council, also called that because it's held at the Vatican. It met between 1962 and 1965. John the 23rd died after its first session, and so it was continued under his successor, Paul the 6th, and it published a little more than a dozen documents. There are four major ones which deal with the liturgy, the church's understanding of itself, the church's role in the modern world, and also God's word, divine revelation. It also addressed other issues like relations with other Christians, relations with other religions. It has documents on like how bishops should interact with social – they didn't call it social media, but with the modern means of communication. It has documents on bishops and religious life. And so that's kind of a sketch of what the two councils dealt with. Are there particular criticisms of Vatican II that perhaps I could help you with?
No, I haven't really read that much into it, but if you have like a reference where I could read more into it, that'd be really great.
Yeah, there's a book that you might want to get on Amazon or elsewhere that I believe it's called A Concise Guide to Vatican II. There's actually also a book on the documents of Vatican I and Vatican II that kind of evaluates, and there are actually a bunch of books that are kind of like this. If you want something specifically addressing criticisms of things going on in the church connected with Vatican II, I would suggest a book called The Pope, the Council, and the Mass. It's by Jim Lycoutis and also Ken Whitehead. And if you just search on The Pope, the Council, and the Mass, that will come up.
Okay, Ty.
Okay, beautiful. Appreciate it.
Also, if you encounter particular claims you're having trouble dealing with, by all means, call us back, and we'll be more than happy to help you with them.
Absolutely. Appreciate it, gentlemen.
Sure. Thank you, Tyler. Appreciate the call. 888-31-TRUTH, the number. We go now to Jason in Texas, listening on St. Valentine Radio, 1360 AM. Jason, your question for Jimmy.
Yes, it's an honor to talk to both of you. I was curious the difference between a Dominican priest, a Franciscan priest, those other orders, and how they relate to a diocesan priest. And if they don't answer to a bishop, how do they get their assignments and who do they work for?
Okay. So a diocesan priest is a priest who properly under canon law belongs to a particular diocese. The technical term for that is he's incardinated in the diocese. And even if he's traveling or serving elsewhere, he's ultimately responsible for the bishop of the diocese in which he's incardinated. Now, religious order priests are different. Religious orders report not principally to the diocesan bishop, but they report principally to their superior in their religious order. And who their superior is will depend on who the religious order is and what type of religious house they're associated with, if they are associated with a particular religious house. But they all have some kind of superior. In terms of the different orders you mentioned, I know you mentioned the Dominicans and the Franciscans. Was there one other?
No, it was just a general question.
Well, the Dominicans go back to the Middle Ages, and they were founded by a man named Saint Dominic. Their official name is the Order of Preachers, and that's why even though it's in Latin, you get the same initials. That's why you see OP after the name of a Dominican to indicate he's a member of the Order of Preachers. And they were founded as their name says, to go out and preach and help educate people religiously on the teachings of the faith. The Franciscans were founded by St. Francis of Assisi, and their charism is a bit different. Francis of Assisi, he was kind of more of a free agent. He was kind of an interesting character, and his charism involved apostolic poverty and being particularly poor. Now, all of these religious orders, they have a vow of poverty that they take, but in the Franciscan order, they wanted to take it especially seriously and be very rigorous about it. And that's kind of informed their charism subsequently. There are more distinctives of these orders. There are certain theological ideas that have become popular in different religious orders based on famous thinkers, like Thomas Aquinas was a Dominican. So his thought is particularly influential in the Dominican order. It's not as influential in the Franciscan order. They have other great theologians that inform their thinking. But if you want to read more about those, a basic introduction could be found on Wikipedia.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Appreciate that call. Let's go now to Larry in Michigan, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Larry, thanks for downloading the app. Your question for Jimmy.
Oh, I understand that due to a necessity, about 300 to 400 years ago, the Pope declared that priests need to be single and not married anymore. Up until that time, they all had wives and children.
Yeah,
and
that's more complex than that.
Pardon?
It's more complex than that.
All right. Well, mm-hmm. I guess here's the real question.
Mm-hmm.
In today's society, why don't they allow men to be married and become priests?
Mm-hmm.
And it would solve a host of problems. You have all kinds of people applying to fill these pulpits, which I understand there's a vacancy. And I just thought that would just solve a lot of issues if they were allowed to be married.
Well, actually, married men can be ordained as priests in some situations. The church allows for that. In some of the Eastern Catholic churches, they regularly ordain married men to the priesthood. Even in the Latin church, married men can be ordained to the priesthood in some situations, such as if they've formerly been a minister in some Protestant groups like, the Anglican Church, and then they become Catholic and want to pursue a ministry as a Catholic priest. There have been men coming from that kind of a background who've been ordained as priests even though they're married. We used to work with one here at Catholic Answers. His name was Father Ray Ryland, and he was our chaplain for many years. And his son, Tim Ryland, is the editor of Catholic Answers magazine. So he's a married Catholic priest in the Latin Rite that I've known personally. In terms of the reason why most Latin priests are not married, there are a couple of reasons. This practice was recommended by Jesus. If you read Matthew chapter 19, he talks about marriage, and he indicates that some men are eunuchs for the kingdom of God. That is, they refrain from marriage for purposes of serving the kingdom of God. And he says that this gift isn't for everyone, but that those who can accept it should. And so it's actually a recommended practice by Jesus. And it's one that he himself participated in. He did not marry. The bride of Christ is the church. There was no Mrs. Jesus that you could go visit in the first century. Jesus himself refrained from marriage as a way of devoting himself wholly to God. And so it's also the final state of mankind, because in the resurrection, we will neither marry nor be given in marriage. So we're all going to be celibate in the next life. Consequently, priests not only devote themselves more fully to the service of God by being celibate, they also follow the example of Jesus, and they anticipate the final state of mankind. St. Paul talks about how an unmarried person is free to devote their entire energies to God and pleasing God, and so they don't have conflicting situations that pull at them and try to take their focus off of God, and that's something that obviously plays a role here. Now, it's true that having more married men could solve some problems. It could also create some problems. One of the things that's true about married men is they have to, by divine law, devote a significant amount of time to their wives and their children. And they can't just as easily get up in the middle of the night to go do a sick call that an unmarried man can. And whether it's in the middle of the night or at some other time of day, they just have less time for ministry than an unmarried man does. And this is something that is experienced, for example, in the Protestant community. Protestant ministers are usually married most of the time, and if you go into a Protestant bookstore, there is guaranteed to be a shelf about how to deal with the problems that exist if you're the wife or the child of a minister. And also there are books for ministers about how to make time for your family and your children, because there's a constant tension between the needs of the family and the needs of the ministry, and it can cause problems. Now, going forward in the church, because this isn't a matter of doctrine, it's a matter of church practice and canon law, it can evolve over time, and the church can make adjustments to fit changing needs. But that's a basic sketch of the reasons why the situation is as it is now, because the church has derived great benefit from this practice being the norm, at least in the Latin Rite of the Church.
And Jason, I hope that that was helpful. We'll have to leave it there because we have to go to a break, but we'll be right back with more Jimmy Akin Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers. Our success depends on you.
Hi, this is Trent Horn, and I'm really excited to tell you about a special limited-time offer we've got right now on subscriptions of our award-winning Catholic Answers magazine. Sign up today during our annual subscription drive, and not only can you save big bucks off the normal price, we'll give you a digital subscription of the magazine for free. Subscribe today by calling 818-487-2011 or by logging online to CatholicAnswersMagazine.com. Sign up for a one-year subscription, and we'll give you $10 off the normal price. But better yet, become a two-year subscriber, and we'll up the ante by dropping the price by $20. That's a savings of $10 to $20 plus a free digital subscription when you sign up for Catholic Answers Magazine. Act now, because this is our best offer of the year, and it's only available for a limited time. Subscribe to Catholic Answers Magazine before our annual subscription drive ends. Phone 818-487-2011 or go to CatholicAnswersMagazine.com.
Wouldn't it be great to have a book to give to anyone to explain exactly why Catholics believe what we believe? Why We're Catholic is the groundbreaking book by apologist Trent Horn, that one book you can give to anyone as a starting point for helping them to find their way into or back to the practice of the Catholic faith. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their faith and values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
EWTN, teaching the truth.
Thank you so very much, first of all, for this ministry. You have no idea what a blessing you and EWTN have been in my life and for my life, and I just thank you for that.
Well, first off, I'd like to say God bless you for your ministry, and my wife prayed daily for EWTN. It's a game changer in our world.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Call now with your question. 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Jimmy is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, and it's open forum, so we're taking questions from anyone about virtually anything having to do with the Catholic faith. Ray in Morgantown, West Virginia, is listening on WLOL Radio, which that's a funny
one. That makes me laugh out loud.
I do. I feel like laughing out loud when I say that. Ray, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hello, Jimmy. Enjoy your program. I had a question about Catholic Church and what position they might have or what protocols are in place for contact with extraterrestrial life.
I'm sorry, I'm not allowed to talk about that.
I don't know how that got. It's top secret, Ray. We can't speak about these things.
So what I can tell you is that the church has no public documents dealing with this, and I'm certain there are no official documents dealing with this question either. There are books and articles that have been written by Catholics on this subject. Brother Guy Consolmagno, who's an astronomer with the Vatican Observatory, for example, has a booklet on extraterrestrial life, and he discusses some of those issues in there. He's not the only one. There are others. I've written and talked and podcast about it. But there are no official procedures that the church has for what we should do if we made contact with extraterrestrials. There are some kind of non-official protocols that have been developed internationally to deal with the question. There were some actually government studies and I believe United Nations studies that were done on the question back in the 60s that addressed some of these questions. They're not very well known, but it's interesting that they exist and that we've done at least some thinking about how we should handle such situations. My own personal recommendation, if we get an incoming message from space, do not answer it for a long time.
But you're generally keeping an open mind about the subject.
Oh, sure. I mean, if aliens come down and land on the lawn, obviously that's going to force the question of how do we interact with them a lot faster. It's certainly possible that there's extraterrestrial life that's intelligent. It's interesting that we haven't run across it yet, given the studies we've been doing, but we may be looking in the wrong places or on the wrong frequencies. We may well discover it. I think there's probably other life here in our own solar system, just not extraterrestrial. One of the reasons I say that is because the solar wind is capable of driving rocks from one planet to another when they get blown off the surface. So thus we found meteorites here on Earth that used to be on Mars but got blasted off the surface of Mars and then blown here into Earth. And some Earth organisms are what are known as extremophiles. They're capable of surviving very extreme environments like tardigrades. And it's quite possible that life from here on Earth got onto other planets either by the meteorite rock method or because they were clinging to space probes we sent there. So we may well find life that originally was native to Earth elsewhere in the solar system.
Okay, Ray.
All right. Thank you for your open mind on the subject, and I appreciate your answers.
Yep. No problem.
Please use the top secret line next time, though.
Right.
All right. These are not things we like to discuss in public. We go now to Jason in Miami, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Jason, your question for Jimmy.
Hi, gentlemen. I just got my second issue of Catholic Answers magazine, and I'm really excited about it.
It's good, isn't it?
I see. I see Jimmy's got an article in there, and then the issue of Humanae Vitae, so it's really great.
Thank you.
I'm excited. My question is, so I was talking about Matthew 16:18 on a Reformed group to get responses, and they said, well, look at 1 Corinthians 10:4 and 1 Peter 2:6. Mm-hmm. Both of those seem to indicate that Christ is the rock or the stone. Mm-hmm. And they also said that the Greek word in 1 Corinthians 10:4 was the same used for Peter in Matthew 16:18. So I was just looking for a reply or a
in dealing with that from you, please.
Okay. Well, I'd have to check the Greek for 1 Corinthians on what word is used there. Normally, the word that's used for rock or stone in the New Testament when it's not Peter isn't Petros. It's lithos, the root from which we get the word lithograph or stone writing. And so I'd have to check on that, but it really doesn't matter. One way or another, the concept of rock or stone gets used metaphorically in the New Testament. But you know what? You can use a metaphor more than one way. And so it's entirely possible to use the word rock as a metaphor for Peter and his role in the church. Obviously, Jesus is doing that. That's why he gave him the name. I mean, John 1:42, Jesus gives him the name Kephas, or Kepha in Aramaic, as a way of metaphorically indicating what his function in the church is going to be. Peter is not literally a rock, so that name has a significance about Peter's character, just like John and James were nicknamed Boanerges or Sons of Thunder because they were going to be fiery preachers in the church. So he gave these people names that were metaphorical. Obviously, James and John were not literally biological sons of thunder. Metaphor is just part of biblical language, and the same metaphor gets used different ways at different times. Thus, Jesus is referred to as the morning star in the book of Revelation. So the morning star is used as a metaphor for Jesus. But you know who else it's used for in Isaiah? The Prince of Babylon. So a single metaphor can be used in more than one context to refer to more than one thing. And if you total up the different metaphors that are used for the foundation of the church in the New Testament, there's actually five of them. Sometimes Jesus is depicted as the foundation. Sometimes Peter is depicted as the foundation. Sometimes the 12 apostles as a group are depicted as the foundation, as in Revelation, when the new Jerusalem comes down out of heaven. Sometimes you have other variants yet, and I wrote about this a while back in a short piece called The Church's Five Foundations. If you want to look that up, just Google Jimmy Akin, Church's Five Foundations, and it should come right up.
And we'll leave it there, Jason, because we've got to try to get as many calls as we can in before we have to go. Let's go to Jesus, I assume, in Battle Creek, Michigan, watching on YouTube. Your question for Jimmy.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, what's your question?
Jimmy, I wanted to ask you, besides Cardinal Dulles's book on the Magisterium, what other resources do you know that can clarify or at least give more instruction on the role of the Magisterium, the grades of ascent to teaching and things like that?
Okay. The first two things I'd recommend are documents. One of them is an instruction that the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith put out in 1990. It's called Donum Veritatis. That means the gift of truth. It's also called the Instruction on the Ecclesial Role of the Theologian. But that's very helpful. Then there is and this isn't actually properly speaking, a magisterial work, but because it doesn't have papal approval. But there was a commentary by Joseph Ratzinger and later Cardinal Bertone called A Doctrinal Commentary on the Concluding Formula of the Professio Fidei. So I'd recommend that. If you want to go deeper and like read book-length works, I would suggest a book called The Gift of Infallibility, by O'Connor. And also I would recommend there are a couple of books by Francis Sullivan. And I have to say, I don't agree with everything Francis Sullivan says, but he's one of the major scholars in this area. You might want to check out his book, also called Magisterium, and another of his books, which has a really problematic title, but it actually is a very informative book, called Creative Fidelity. And finally, the book you really want to get that's going to be, the grand slam on all this, you want to get my forthcoming book, either called Teaching with Authority or called Dogma, Doctrine, and Theology.
And you're going to have to wait for that one because it takes Jimmy at least a week to get a book published. So, but it'll be coming. Just keep your eyes open for that. Thank you, Jesus, so much for that question. Thanks to everybody who called. Thank you, Jimmy Akin, for
my
a fine
pleasure.
Couple of hours.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. Always,
plus 15-minute pre-show before.
Well, most of the 15-minute pre-show.
Yeah. But,
always like getting together.
Yeah, nice hanging out with you. Tomorrow, Scott Hahn's going to be here. You probably heard of him, Scott Hahn. He's got a brand new book about marriage as the foundation of society. So hang out with us tomorrow as we close the work week with a discussion with Scott Hahn about the family and its place in society. We'll see you then, God willing, on Catholic Answers Live.